Man, that magic twanger makes a really strange noise. It sounds like a person talking. Good evening, everyone. This is the NLA Hams Net. This net is held every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. It's for discussion of ham things and NLA things. So if you have either one of those topics or you hit them both, please bring your questions, comments, suggestions, or anything else. Oh, last week we were talking about discrete components. And that's probably where I'll start. Everybody with a book, look at page 3-10. So there we are. Do we have any holdover questions, any prior business, anything at all that anybody wants to talk about? And we will do so. Please call now. I am Terry from Colorado, KI0RE. I heard no response, so I'm just going to press on like I know what I'm doing. Not a problem. On page 3-10 in Chapter 3, there's diodes, transistors, and integrated circuits, and they have some pictures. Now, one of the top shows diodes, and the bottom one shows transistors. And integrated circuits, they just take a whole bunch of transistors and diodes and resistors and put them in a tiny, tiny little package. You've probably seen a dual, what's called a dual inline. Noise, buddy. Can you mute yourself if you're making the noise?
Yeah, I just did it. Sound like we had the Fife and Bugle Corps coming to town.
Yeah, it did. Okay, a diode is a solid-state device, but it doesn't have to be solid-state. It can be tubes in some large situations where you need a lot of power. Oftentimes, it is a tube. It allows the conduction of electricity in one direction only. So they're usually marked with a positive and a negative side. And if you hook the negative to the generally negative side of a circuit and the positive to a generally positive side of the circuit, it will conduct electricity. You flip that around, it doesn't conduct anything at all. As a matter of fact, what happens is you got the holes or the electrons coming in on one side, and it tends to drive off the electrons so that you have a gap in the middle. I could show you if I had a whiteboard, but I'm kind of short on that right now. Let's just say that diodes, di means two, and odes is talking about how many connections you have. It has two connections. One side is positive, one side is negative, and if you hook it up with the negative and positive, it'll conduct electricity all day. If you hook it the other way, or your circuit decides to go a different way, it will stop the flow of electricity. One place where it's used quite often is on an inductor. If you think about an inductor, we talked about inductors last week. And if you charge up an inductor to where it's got a magnetic field around it, which anytime it has electrons flowing, it has a magnetic field, it will, as you take off the electromotive force, it starts to decay, and it will try and collapse that magnetic field all at once and keep the current going. A diode is set counter to that, and it will short the descending magnetic field, the current that's generated. It'll short that current out to itself, and now you won't have any problem. So there's some things that can be done. Anyway, now the next thing I want to talk about is in the second drawing on figure 311. It's on page 310. And there's transistors. Transistors come in all kinds of configurations. There's big packs and little packs. Generally, the larger a transistor is, the more current it will have, or the more current it can carry. And because of that, it depends upon your circuit as to how big the transistors you're using are. But you can see a few of those, and it goes from very small to a very large one. And that large one might hold 2, 3, 4 amps, depending upon what the rating is. So it's kind of in an oval shape, and it's got some really tiny ones. Now, so far, these have been what's called discrete components. In other words, you need a transistor in a circuit, and you pick a discrete component, like you need a transistor in a circuit, so you pick a transistor and you put it in the circuit. The next step up, what they realized, let me back up just a second. What they realized is that there was tyranny in numbers. And in the 50s, two guys came up with the idea of a transistor. And I won't go into that one right now, but I just want to tell you that as the circuits got more and more involved, they realized it would take them days to hook up a circuit, get all the soldering joints done, and look for bad places. And they said, we got to come up with something different here. So what they came up with is an integrated circuit. And the integrated circuit might have many transistors and many diodes, many resistors, and many capacitors inside of it. Now, what does that do? You shrink it down. And the idea is that if you build it right, it will hold a significant amount of current and still do all the switching that you want it to do. To do a lot of outside stuff like throw a relay or move a machine or a stepper motor, usually you have to use a transistor out there to amplify the current, because too much current will fry an IC chip. But an IC is just something that has many transistors and many diodes in it. And you've seen them. They're a little rectangular black package with maybe 8 pins on one side and 8 pins on the other. You look in the older electronic equipment now, excuse me, and you might see a lot of them stacking up. Well, they got better and better at integrated circuit design. They got smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, CPU is a type of integrated circuit, but it's got millions of transistors, diodes, and everything else it needs. And there's pictures you can see in books and textbooks especially of the whole thing maps out to a certain pattern, and it's blocked off that this part of the IC chip does the computations, this part does the memory control, this part does something else. And it was quite the challenge to design those, but once they started designing them, they could also make them smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And now they put millions of transistors on a single IC chip, and they call it a CPU, a central processing unit. Okay, discrete components, diodes, transistors, resistors. We talked a little bit about resistors last week, and we talked about resonance, and we talked about capacitors. I'm looking on page 3-11, and it talks about two types of material, an N and a P type, N type and a P type material. N just says it's a negative side. And a diode is just an N-type and a P-type stuck together. And then when you bias them one way, they conduct right through the interface between the two. If you bias them the other way, they kind of repel each other and they don't conduct. There's a really neat thing that happens in a transistor. It has the N, it has a P, but it has another N or another P. If there's two N-type transistors, it has an NPN transistor. If it has two P-type transistors, then you have a PNP transistor. Why do you have two types of transistors? Well, the answer is, that sometimes you need your biasing it a certain way, and it has to be biased in a positive direction to get it to work right. And then other times you're biasing in a negative direction to make it work right. So it all depends on where it goes in the circuit. Let's see. Oh, and then they talk about bipolar junction of transistors, BJT. That's what I was talking about, where they come together, the N-type and the P-type substrates. The BJT is made from three alternating layers of N and P-type material, NPN or PNP, referring to the arrangement of the layers. But you, in effect, you use them differently. Well, you use them the same way, only in different circuits, because you want them biased the right way. What does a transistor do? It uses a tiny little current to control a very large current. So the normal way that a transistor works, and this isn't gospel, it's not how it works every time, but your main thing that you're trying to control, the main current flow that you're trying to control, goes from the collector to the emitter, or the emitter to the collector. The transistors have three leads. Remember we talked about they had three leads in the picture on figure 311. Those three leads are the base, the emitter, and the collector. The collector and the emitter control they conduct a very large current. The base is where you put whatever signal you want to control that current. So if you put a tiny little signal in there, maybe a sine wave, it comes out as a great big sine wave on the other side of the transistor. As a matter of fact, everybody's heard, well, most everybody my age has heard of these little Japanese transistor radios. Well, what they did was they put stages where they would bias them properly and put these transistors. So the output of one drove the base of the next one, and the output of that one drove the base of the next one, and they might have four or five stages. By the end of that process, you had this tiny, tiny little microvolt signal that was driving enough energy to drive the speaker, and you could hear the sound. And that, I remember, was revolutionary. You now had a radio you could stick in your pocket, and that was a mid-50s to late 50s. Jan, did you see those? When was that? Since you're so much older than I am.
Good question.
Good assumption, right?
Yep. Yeah,
okay.
Assumption.
So somewhere around the late 50s is what I remember. Transistor radios started coming out. They came from Japan. We didn't have any at first, and then we had a lot of them. I can remember my parents buying an AM-FM radio, and it was a desktop model, but it was portable. It was small enough you could pick it up. I'd say it's about the size of a lunchbox, maybe a little bit thinner than a lunchbox, but about that size, width and height. And that was a lot of fun. I really loved tinkering with that. And if I could, sometimes I could turn it up just a little bit past the 108 that it was supposed to have. And we had an airport close enough where I could hear their tower because of that. So anyway, long time ago. They don't do it like that anymore. All right, back to the subject. We got off a little bit there. And then we have protective components, because these components, these discrete components that been talking about, transistors, resistors, diodes, and capacitors, they cost money. And if you let too much current go through, you know, transistor is oftentimes the most expensive thing in the circuit. That didn't That's not so true anymore, but it is an expensive part. Back when I was young and starting to put things together, that was very much true. I could spend a lot of money on transistors. Luckily, my mother worked at Texas Instruments, which built transistors, and they told her, if it falls on the floor, don't pick it up. We're just going to assume it's bad. And so she'd bring home the stuff they'd swept off the floor, and she'd give it to me. So I had lots of transistors, and I could build just about anything I wanted. And then, anyway, I seem to be taking lots of forks today down memory lane. You don't want a lot. You don't want too much current going through there. Now, everybody is familiar with fuses. They have a in figure 3.12. There's a couple of car fuses and the long fuses, and then a circuit breaker. The difference between a fuse and a circuit breaker, they do the same thing, is that when they reach the limit of their current, a fuse will blow up. It burns up. They cut the metal at a certain thickness and a certain width, and they know that that metal, whatever they use in there, and I don't know what they use, but at that metal at this width and this thickness, if it has the current that it's rated for, let's say 5 amps, flow through it, that little junction, that's wide, narrow part that's thin, it will get so hot from the current flowing by, it'll burn open, and the fuse opens up. And the idea is a fuse will blow or a circuit breaker will trip based upon how much current is flowing. And by having this, the fuse open up, burn up, or the circuit breaker trip, you save your electronic components from getting fried. Because you want to pick your fuses since smaller than the highest expected voltage, or right just at the highest expected current that goes through the device. And it's a circuit protection. Or I've done this before. I actually touched the wrong thing to the ground in the car accidentally one time. And I thought my radio had died. No, the fuse blew up. So I had to get a new fuse and stick it in there and be a little more careful. But I would certainly rather have a fuse blow out and lose a buck or 2 bucks or 50 cents, whatever they cost, than have my radio, which costs several hundred dollars, or maybe a Bofang costs $30. I'd much rather have the fuse burn up or the circuit breaker trip. So when you open your electrical panel, wherever it is in your house, and you look at those things you can flip, those are circuit breakers. And when they break, you should be very leery about resetting them. Reset it once. If it breaks right away again or pretty quick, I would say that you've got too much load on that whatever's running in that circuit, that you're getting more than 15 amps. The picture on page 3-11 has a 15 on the little lever. That means that at 15 amps or just over 15 amps, that breaker will trip and open up the circuit. If you continually reset it, you might be burning something up, and you're going to have to buy a new TV set, a new toaster, or whatever it is that's taking too much current. You need to get that fixed. Usually in a house, most of your circuit breakers drive either lights or they drive the wall. Well, if it drives a wall, you want to unplug some stuff until it doesn't trip. You preferably unplug everything, turn it on, it doesn't trip. Plug in one thing, try it. And maybe, let's say you plug in a toaster, and the toaster has a short in it, and you didn't know that. And so you push it down, and it immediately trips the breaker. Oh, it's time to get a new toaster at that point. Do I have any questions so far?
This is KC3HVA. You caught me unawares on that question about little transistor radios, because at that time, late 50s, even early 50s, I listened to 110-volt radio. I never had a little transistor radio, couldn't afford one. I remember people walked around with these lunchbox-size portable radios. They had B batteries and tubes in them prior to that. So,
yep.
And just a comment on your discrete component stuff. When I took circuit design, would have been in the late 50s, we had discrete components to make a flip-flop, which is the basis of the modern digital computer. It took about 4 resistors, a couple capacitors, a couple transistors, and you put them on a board. The board might have been, just for convenience, you know, inch or two square. And by the time about 1975 rolled around, they could stuff about 250,000 of those on one little chip that was, well, between 1/4 by 1/4 and 3/8 by 3/8. So they did make tremendous strides. Now, like you say, the modern CPU, central processing unit, has a gazillion little flip-flops in it, or little binary states. They just flip from 2 voltages. They're either 0 or 5 volts or whatever they're using for their standard. So the flip-flop just flips from one state to another state, and that's the way you keep track of everything digitally. Over.
Very good. Thank you, Jan. I appreciate the input. What you did, you brought back another memory, so I'm just going to tell it since I have before. And when my mom brought home some of those transistors, I had already started fooling around, and I would just lay all the components out and solder them together. Well, my dad said, well, that's not real efficient. Here, put it on a piece of cardboard. Just punch a hole in the cardboard, stick it through, and then solder one side and keep all your discrete components on top. And I did that, and I thought that was cool. And I remember reading Forrest Mims III's little transistor projects, and I made a few of them and took them to school, showed them off, and brought them, come back home, and I just had a lot of fun doing that and making it work the way that it's supposed to. Never did go into deep electronics, but I did get some training in the Air Force. But I had a lot of fun punching holes in cardboard, or not cardboard, what was it? Yeah, like a cardboard box. I would cut off a flap of the cardboard box, cut it down to the size I wanted, punch a hole with a nail, and then push the leads through, and then I'd label the leads so I would solder the right ones, and I'd solder up the circuit together from what Forrest Mims III would write down, and you could get his books from Radio Shack. They're still out there on the net now. Pretty fun. And that was long before I ever saw a breadboard. When I finally saw a breadboard, I said, I have to have one of those, but it was in the 70s before I saw my first breadboard and got it. Okay. Back to the subject. I'm going to turn the page to page 3-12, and it talks about fuses, interrupt current overloads, and blah, blah, blah. Circuit breakers act like fuses tripping when current overloads occur. Talks about that. And then he talks about GFCI. And GFCI stands for ground fault circuit interrupter. And this is a handy little device to have. And you may have one either in your garage or in your bathrooms. And what it does is if it detects that something is going to ground, if the hot wire or the neutral is going to ground, it trips on just a fraction of the current. Now, you can run regular stuff like a hair dryer or something like that, but if you throw something in the water, I don't recommend you do that. It makes a big mess. But if you drop something accidentally in the water, instead of electrocuting you, the ground fault interrupt disconnects the entire circuit so that there's nothing going to that socket anymore. And I had one in the garage right where I came out in my last house, and it actually drove the sockets upstairs and the one in the garage. And I thought that was kind of strange, but I found a lot of things that I thought were strange after I'd lived in the house a while. So it's a good little thing to have, especially when you're around water. And when they first came out, I remember the stories about people who wanted to prove that they were good, and they tossed a leads into a pool and let it run. So they'd toss that one AC lead over at this end of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And then this guy, to prove it, had his daughter jump in the water. Anybody that knows how electricity goes through the contaminants of the water knows that that girl could be electrocuted, but as soon as she touched the water, the ground fault interrupt kicked in and cut off all current flowing. So it's a neat little device and a good thing to have if there's any chance that you're going to short something out. It will save your life. So the next thing that I wanted to talk about.
Terry?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just a comment. You mentioned that up to three or so outlets came off your one GFI outlet. Most of them now will run three beyond the one that you have, the first one installed. Or you can put a master in your fuse panel and run like four off of that. Now, I always assumed that this went even further. Anytime you have an imbalance between the high and low and ground, that interrupts or trips, makes a breaker. And so if you happen to get across the hot wire and you go to ground without going through the panel, and you're really getting zapped with 110 or what, it should kick off and stop you from getting the jitters and other things. Over.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, Jan. I remember the situation of how I knew that those two were connected. I had a freezer out in the garage. There wasn't a plug where I wanted it, so I ran an extension cord around a wall and plugged it in. And one day I come home and the freezer's off. It's starting to drain. I had a big mess I had to clean up, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And eventually, I noticed that I thought the freezer was broke, but the next morning, I noticed that the GFCI was flipped. It was punched out. Usually there's a button on it. You can test it. So I pushed it back in, and I said, wait a minute. And I ran down, and the freezer was back on and running, and that's how I found out that it was hooked to the same circuit. Okay, surge protectors. Surge protectors limit voltage transient above normal voltages by turning into resistors when the voltage gets too high. Then they dissipate as heat the energy that comes in. There's inside of surge protectors, which you're used to seeing a big long strip, almost all of those power strips now that you buy, with a cord on it that you can plug in and run three or four to five devices off of. Our devices run so much less current now that you can do that and get away with it, and you're not topping out what the line will carry. But what happens is you get a spike from the electric company or lightning striking something, and that little burst of energy comes down the line into your room, into that plug and down into that surge protector. Well, when it gets to the surge protector, almost all of them now have what's called an MOV. And an MOV, don't ask me what it stands for, I don't remember, but it will absorb, anytime you have that voltage like that, it will bypass and not let it go into the equipment. But it can only do it so much. And they usually measure how much it'll do in joules, which is a measure of how much force there is behind it. And once those MOVs, they can absorb X amount. And once those MOVs have absorbed the amount that they can take, they open up. And once they open up, you no longer have surge protection inside that little power strip. So if you're using a really old power strip, which I am in a couple of places, just be aware that it'll deliver power, but it's not protecting you from diddly squat. So be careful. And if you want to be protected, put a new one in whenever you move. I've got them on some stuff that I really don't care whether it blows up or not. And so I've got it for little nit-noy stuff that is inconsequential, and a surge isn't going to hurt it. Okay.
Question, Terry?
Yes, Jim.
They do make those surge protectors now in a large size. You can mount them on your 100-amp, 200-amp panel in the house. And when the voltage exceeds a certain amount and it's wired right across the 240, it'll blow and blow trip the breaker. And it's a one-shot device. Once it turns on, it shorts and just dumps everything to ground. And it's pretty much destroyed because you can't kick the breaker back on until you disconnect it. So it isn't too good. Now, we have a power company here in Pennsylvania that delights in turning off the power on a, I think it's a Saturday morning about 10. And then they'll pop it right back on a little bit, you know, I don't know, half a minute, 10 seconds later, which puts one very high transient down the line. And I was foolish enough here, you know, 10 years ago maybe, to buy a freezer that had a digital readout. Well, that little transient went in there and punched the control out, so it doesn't read accurately, so on and so forth. So because of that, and since these digital devices are so sensitive, the power company now sells you insurance. So if your appliances are damaged, they will pay. Now, to me, that's kind of a circuitous loop. They create the problem and then charge you to insure so that you don't have to pay when you get zapped. Over.
Thank you, Jan. That's a very good point. And it's, to me, it's highway robbery, so I agree with you.
Yes, it is.
Okay, now the next thing that's on there is they talk about lightning arresters, but I'm not going to go over that for my moment. I'm going to talk about the circuit gatekeepers, and they say the gatekeepers are switches. So figure 3.14 is a bunch of switches, and they show several type, a rotary switch, a toggle switch, a push-button switch, a slide switch, and a little micro switch thing. And that looks kind of strange unless you've tried to reprogram the code on your garage door. You go out, you buy a brand new garage door, you hit the button, and the neighbor's door goes up along with yours. Oh, one of you needs to change code. Well, since you're the new kid on the block, you change your code. To get that code changed, you use one of these micro switches like that, and it might have 8, 16, or 32 switches across there, and you got to have the same code there as you have in your garage door opener. And so they have some pictures of them there, and I would encourage you to take a look at them. And then there's something on the right, and it's called a relay. When you really have to handle a high current device, multiple amps, and you want to isolate the circuit, you can control a relay with just 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 volts, 12 volts, and it will flip 120 volt AC that you wouldn't even want to get near your IC chips or your discrete components, your digital components that we're talking about. And I arranged and built a, when I was on alert at the alert facility at Carswell Air Force Base, I built a little thing that would switch the projectors. We would show movies in there, we'd get reduced size one, and, you know, it's just 16 millimeter. And I made it so that when you hit a button, you could set it up, and when you're ready to go, you hit a button and get the little thing in the corner, hit the button, and it would switch to the other projector immediately. And it worked very well for a long time. I know it at least lasted at least a year and a half until I was grounded for some other stuff, medical conditions. And you use relays to do that because then you isolate one circuit from another. So a relay allows you to switch, turn something on or turn something off, just like a switch, only it's not a switch. It's controlled by electricity. And you control a relay by turning on a little inductor, which turns the center of it into a little magnet. And that magnet pulls an arm over with contacts on it, and it keeps it contact. As long as you keep voltage there, it will run stuff, and it will allow the circuit to be closed. As soon as you remove that voltage, it has a spring. It pulls the arm back, disconnects the circuit, and everything stops. So I had it to where when I hit the button, it would switch, and this projector would come on, and that one would go off, both at the same time, and then I could set up the next reel of whatever movie was coming along. Switches and relays are described in a number of poles. Oh, there you go, poles and throws. You can switch multiple circuits with a single switch. That's called multiple poles. So you can have one, which is what normal little switches have, or you can have two or three. So when you put the switch up, all three poles flip to the new position. And you can have a different circuit running through each one of those. So you can actually turn three things on or off at the same time with just a switch, as long as you have three poles. But normally you just have one. Now, throw is how far does it go? Does it just have two throws? In other words, it's on or it's off. Or is it double throw? Double throw means that when it hooks this way, there's a center tap, and when you put it up, it goes to the upside of the contacts. And then when you put it down, it connects to the downside. Well, if you just want an on-off switch, you just use the center connector and the top connector. And then when you throw it up, whatever's connected to the top completes the circuit, and then it does whatever it's supposed to do. When you want it off, you pull it down, and there's nothing connected on the bottom, and so it disconnects that that current path. So that's a single throw. It only does one. A double throw, you throw it up, it connects the top row or the top connectors to the center connector. You throw it down, it connects the bottom connectors to the center connector. And you can have one or the other. You can connect the center connector to the tops, or you can connect the centers to the bottom. But you can't connect them both at the same time. And if there's two like that, two conditions, it's a double throw. So what you have on the wall on most lights, and I want to emphasize that I'm not talking about hall lights if you got a hall, but like a single room light, you have a single pole, single throw switch. It only turns on that one light, and when you put it down, it turns it off. There's only one throw that'll work, and it's only got one pole on it because it's only used in one circuit. In the hallway, you want to be able to turn the light on, and it applies for stairs also. If a person is upstairs, you want to be able to turn on the light, and you want to, if you're downstairs, you want to be able to turn it off when you go down and reverse the process coming up so that you have some light. And to do that, you need a double pole, double throw switch on each one, and you wire them up in a crossed fashion. So if they're both off, if they're both in the same position, the light's off. If there are one's up and one's down, the light's on. And it doesn't matter which one you turn up and which one you turn down, the light's on. that's an interesting study in how to do that, and I'm willing to accept anybody that wants to show me how it works as a homework test. Oh, what else can we talk about? I think we should talk about that. Leave that next time. Yes.
There are a couple other neat switches, too. For example, if you're running a motor that's reversible, there's a switch that has three positions. One is off in the center, on one way, or on the other way. So if you want to run the motor forward, you might turn it on to the forward position, and then you want to turn it off and let the motor stop before you try and make it go the other way. And when it stops, then you kick it down and it runs the other way. There's another one that's kind of a combination on and momentary. Supposing you have the easiest example is a motor, and it takes a certain amount of current to run, and then higher current to start. So you might have an extra current source on the momentary contact. So if you flip the switch, it's either off or on, and if you push it up against a spring, it gets that extra current hooked in there to start the motor, and you let go, and then it runs normally with the normal running current. And there's a number of other different ones, too, that get kind of exotic that are useful for different applications. Over.
Absolutely. Jan, you're perfectly right again. And, yes, it all depends on what the application is and what you need. But just about any switch you need, you can get it nowadays. When I was there, all my switches, my dad, my mom worked making transistors. My dad worked for an airline. He was a mechanic. So he would bring home switches that didn't work very well anymore because you can't have it where it occasionally works or occasionally doesn't work. Either one could kill a lot of people. So he'd have to take and replace a switch. Well, he'd bring it home so I could use it when I was tinkering around. And I had some switches. I had to pull on them to push them up or push on them to push them up. It just all depends. And I had a lot of fun figuring that stuff out and never forgot it. I would like to encourage everybody to read schematics and composite component symbols starting on page 3-13, well-grounded symbols. And then 3-14, it shows you the schematics symbols for all of these things. And that's not going to make sense unless you can look at the picture, because schematics are based upon being able to see the picture and trace the wire path through there. So I'm going to talk about those next week, and you'll get more out of it if you take a look at it before we have our talk. And unless somebody else wants to say something, I'll be closing the net. So if anybody wants to say one last word or ask a question, please call now.
I guess
nothing
the
heard.
Word is, the word is
what?
Good night. See you next
okay,
week.
Okay, word's good night. This is the NLA Hamsnet. I am Terry from Colorado. I am KI0RE. And this net is held every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Everyone is welcome to join, whether you're in NLA or a ham or neither or both. And we talk about NLA ham things and ham things. So thank you very much for participating. And I hope you all have a wonderful night. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.